All right, today we're going to look at Psalm 49 and hopefully Genesis, or Exodus, excuse me, Exodus 5 and 6. But we normally open up with a psalm, and we're in Psalm 49 now, and that means we've come a pretty long way. We've read a lot of psalms, and we've read a lot of different kinds of psalms. So we read, you might remember, we read that wedding psalm, and we read some lamenting psalms, and sometimes the psalms are easier, sometimes they're harder, but this one, this psalm, is maybe a little bit easier because he begins by letting us know why he's writing. So really there shouldn't be confusion. And Katie, you can read the first line for us.
Okay. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre.
Okay, stop there. So who's he talking to? He kind of addresses who? This is someone from Israel, and he's talking to who? He says it a couple different ways.
All inhabitants
of the world. So all peoples, all inhabitants of the world. Then he keeps going. He wants to make clear.
Both low and high.
Both low and high, rich and poor. So that's four different ways of saying he is talking to the entire world, everyone. Doesn't matter whether you're powerful, doesn't matter whether you're weak, doesn't matter whether you're really from Israel or a Gentile. He wants everyone to hear that, this. And again, this is kind of neat to read because it's what Israel was supposed to be doing. In a sense, it was Israel's purpose. And what is he going to do in this psalm? He tells us what his intention is.
He's going to speak wisdom.
He's going to, hello, Yak. Nice to see you. He's going to give wisdom. And so he's going to share the meditation of his heart. He says what he's been thinking. And he's going to give understanding. And then it's like he's going to use music to teach. So that's what's going on. And wisdom, of course, is the skill of really living life well, applying scripture to the nitty-gritty issues of life. So this psalm is for everyone, and it's for the purpose of helping us understand how to live. And so then the question is, what's he going to teach? And so you can read the next line.
Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches?
Okay, so stop there for a second. You remember how he talked about a riddle? And this is kind of a riddle. So what's the question that he's asking?
It's basically, why should I be afraid when people... Okay, yeah,
so stop there. He says, why should I be afraid? Which is a good question in general, right? Why should I be afraid? But look more carefully, when is he asking that question specifically? What's going on in his life?
When people are like, he says, the sin of those who cheat against me surrounds me.
Okay, so what's the picture?
It's like there's a bunch of people that are sitting and it's affecting him.
Right. So he says he's in times of trouble. You got to kind of just pick it apart. So he says, why should I be afraid in times of trouble? So he's saying this is a season in my life that can be characterized by trouble. And specifically, it's not just any kind of trouble. People are sinning and they're cheating him. And it's almost like he's swimming in an ocean of their sin. Their sin is surrounding him, or he's like in a room filled with sin, and it's like attacking sin. These are people who are trying to take advantage of him. And what kind of people are they? He describes the kind of people they are.
They trust in their wealth.
Okay, so that means if you say how would you describe them in other words then?
They're rich.
They're rich, but they're not just rich,
they kind of rely on their riches, and that's their main identity.
Yeah, they rely on their riches. What's the next word that he says?
They boast of the abundance.
Okay, so boast. What are you doing when you boast? What kind of person boasts? What?
They're bragging.
They're bragging. What kind of, when you meet a boastful person, what's a nice word for a boastful person? Crowd's not so nice. Yeah.
I can't think of that.
Confident. You'd say these people are confident. These people are sure of themselves. So they're attacking him. and they're not really worried about what they're doing. So he's in a room filled with people who are out to get him, and these people they're not worried like it's going to come back to haunt them. They're confident, and they're confident because they're rich. They're confident because they're powerful. And so how is this a riddle? Imagine that you're in a time of trouble, and the trouble is people are out to get you, and they're cheating you, and they're taking advantage of you, and they're attacking you, and they're convinced they're going to get away with it because they're wealthy and they're powerful. And the question is, why should you be afraid? And I love that question because it seems like the opposite of what you would ask. What would you normally ask? Why shouldn't I be afraid? Like, why should I be afraid? I just told you why I should be afraid. And so that's the riddle. We have to figure out, why is the psalmist so confident? Like, he's in the same room with all these people who are out to get him, who are so proud of themselves, and he's not worried. And figuring out why he's not worried is what's going to give us wisdom and understanding to live life. So we're like watching this guy, and we're trying to learn from him kind of the secret to living life well in this world. And so the question is, what is the reason he shouldn't fear? And he's going to tell us here.
Truly no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit.
Okay, we'll stop there. So that's the first little glimpse into how he thinks. What's he saying there? Okay.
Give us an offering, like another person.
Right. So these people are confident in their money. They really think their money can save them. And he's saying, well, let's look at your money a little bit better. Your money is not able to save you from death. You can't, give God enough money that you're able to live on forever and not see the pit. The pit's basically, the grave. So your money, you are so confident, but your money really isn't able to do for you what's most important, and it's not able to keep you alive forever. And why is that a problem? Next verse, everybody dies. And then when they die, they stay dead. So he says four. So he's going to explain what he means. Yeah.
For he sees that even the wise die. The fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names. Men in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence, yet after them people approve of their boasts. Selah.
So Selah means think about it, but it's like he's saying, think about this. Don't you see that it's kind of madness? People are so confident because they're wealthy, but they die. And it doesn't matter if they were rich, even if they had lands called after their names. Pennsylvania, Maryland, even all these states where you have an entire state named after someone. What good does it do Mary now that you have Maryland or Penn, William Penn now? That's called Pennsylvania. And so the result is they're not really much different than an animal. They might be so confident, but it's kind of like they're on a plane that's crashing. And imagine a plane that is about to crash, and yet there's a guy up in first class, and he's like bragging about his yachts. And the plane is like literally going down, and he's up there standing. He's like, yeah, I got a huge yacht, and we travel all over the world with it. And then he's got like a group of people in first class sitting around him who are like, wow, that is awesome. That you're so lucky. That's amazing. And what would you think? You'd think, what is going on, man? This plane is crashing. It doesn't really matter if you have a yacht. And you're really stupid, basically. And yet maybe you think, well, I'm on the same plane. But he continues because here's some hope. Like sheep.
like sheep they are pointing for Sheol. Death will be, shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me, Sheol.
Okay, so he says, no, there's a contrast here. He says, no man can ransom another with money. In other words, no man can save his life from death with money. So if they're trusting in money, what's going to end up happening is that they die and are punished. Death shall be their shepherd. That's not a shepherd that you really want, right? Imagine. And the upright shall rule over them. Their form will be consumed, but God will ransom my soul. And I think that's the hope of the resurrection of the dead. This is a hopeful psalm that's supposed to teach. And he's saying, don't be afraid of the wicked and get so intimidated by them, because they're going to die and be punished. But God's going to rescue the righteous from that. And so the question is, what do you do now? And because remember, this is a wisdom psalm. And so here's the wisdom again, McKen.
Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praised when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish.
Which sounds pretty similar to what he said, but there's a little difference, so let's work it through. He says, don't be afraid when a wicked man becomes rich and powerful, for when he dies, he can't take his glory with him. And so while he's alive, he's proud of himself. That's how the world works. But he's going to die like all those before him, and he's going to go into the darkness. And here's the line that looks like he's repeating himself. He says, man in his pomp is like the beasts that perish. And he said that part before, but he adds what here? What part does he add? So say it a little more loudly, honey.
Without understanding.
So he says, man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like beasts that perish. So he's saying, what separates man from the beasts? It's definitely not just that he has money. He needs understanding. So he says, the rich man without understanding is like a beast that perish. He's like an animal. And what's the key thing he wants us to understand? I think it's this. It's looking at life from the perspective of death and what happens after death. And so he's saying, you know what really can separate us from the animals, if you want to live a life that's wise, is to look at life from the perspective of what comes after this life. And so what are some ways that we might be susceptible even now to the temptation that he's addressing in this psalm? We might not have, be in a room filled with people who are trying to take advantage of us, but how is this psalm so relevant even now?
I feel like it's the entire world telling us to live our best life now.
Yeah.
Right? This prosperity gospel, as a preaching, and we fall trapped. I mean, just even yesterday, right? Just seeing how we can fall trapped into, worshiping wrong things. We put my dog down yesterday. That was just very interesting. Yeah, people I've encountered through this last couple weeks of journey of it, and just seeing how they talk and what they say. They have their entire hope wrapped around dogs and glory and this. And yeah, it was very, very surreal just hearing that. But yeah, we fall into a false gospel.
Right.
This is what we're called to, and this is why we do good things, and this is why we love so much. Mm-hmm. This is why I do all this. It's because your dog is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It was really, really interesting. So maybe, people are not attacking us in a sense, individually, but they are attacking us to indoctrinate us with their gospel.
And you're saying something funny. You're saying that even nowadays, there's a little bit of a different problem, is people have degressed in that they don't realize man is supposed to be different than the beasts that perish.
Mm-hmm.
So this psalm is kind of assuming that we would know that humans are different than beasts that perish. Yeah. But we've even taken a step back now a little bit in that we are just thinking it's all the same. But here, I think one way this psalm is definitely still so relevant is that we are tempted to be intimidated by wealthy people. So, and really impressed. And so we like shiny things, you know. So if a really wealthy person comes in, we see somebody drive in with a Mercedes or whatever, really wealthy person, automatically it's easy to put them in this special, unique position and to kind of think they have a little bit of power, a little bit of wisdom. You know, it's funny, money is the only thing. Like, if somebody's really good at, you know, certain things, like fixing cars, you don't think that guy's good at everything.
Making banana bread.
Yeah. But money is one of those things. Somebody has a lot of money, people are tempted to even take their advice on everything. So they have a lot of money. You'll listen to them talk about parenting. You'll listen to them talk. Somehow they're experts in every area just because they're good at making money. And so we're easily intimidated by people who have a lot of money, and yet he's saying that doesn't make a lot of sense because what good does it do them in the long run if that money can't save them from death? And so what really is wise is not knowing how to make a lot of money. What's really wise is knowing how to live forever. And that comes from a relationship with
like
God.
To that point, it reminds me a lot of like some of my friends that I minister with, or two, of the idea of growing up impoverished, growing up in rough areas who are now believers, and kind of the idea of like being warped by the gospel of the world.
Yeah, sure. Right?
That the rich are out to get you. And there's probably some truth behind it.
Well, that's what he's saying here, yeah.
Yeah, but it's so much like, it's to the extreme that there's hatred within their hearts.
Yeah.
Like that, you know?
And also cool that he would actually come and say, why should you be intimidated?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why should you be afraid? And his situation's still the same. He's still in this room filled with sinners who want to cheat him. But he's actually kind of like, he's scratching his head. It's like, why am I afraid when I'm in this room? It's like, because, you know, my hope is in God, and I have the resurrection of the dead, and that changes even the way I feel in this room. That's the way it changes my whole perspective. One of the problems when you get so scared by riches that, or you sort of react like that, is that you actually give them more power than they have. And so even as you respond to that, they're still controlling you because you're responding to trying to overcome them. So they've just given them too much power. And that's kind of what he's trying to say. You got to be smart. All right, Psalm, that's our opening prayer. Lord, please help us to be wise and not live like people without understanding. It's one thing to see a dog be a dog. It's a whole other thing to see a human be a dog, right? So we don't expect much different from people who don't have a new nature, who don't have the Holy Spirit, and who actually do think we're just going to die and go into the ground. But people who understand, who've been given this grace to understand something bigger and more profound, certainly shouldn't regress and go back to thinking like people who think this life is all there is. All right, Exodus 5 and 6. Let's see, we got 30 minutes. Exodus is such a big book. I've been just loving going through Exodus. And you remember God's telling the story of how he's going to rescue the world. And in Genesis, we get God's plan and his agenda. And we saw that his plan is for the whole world. It's not just for a small little part of the world. And he wants to deal with the problems in the world. So it's almost like, the end of Genesis. He wants to take evil and turn it to good. And so we saw how that's going to happen. It's going to happen through the seed of the woman. And then we saw that the woman, it's actually going to be more specific. It's going to come through Israel. And he gave Israel some promises like, okay, this is what's going to happen. You're going to be a great people. You're going to have kings come from you. I'm going to give you land. And then I'm going to use you to bless the entire world. And so at the end of Genesis, we got the beginnings of a people. We don't really have a nation yet, but we got about 70 guys from an old man who didn't look like he could have any children. Mm-hmm. And we have no land. We don't have land. All we have is this hope. And Joseph and Jacob both say, they show that they have this hope. They're like, hey, take me back to the promised land. Take my bones back to the promised land when it happens. So now Exodus. And chapter 1 and 2, it's like, okay, the plan is on. And we see God is keeping his promise to Israel. They're bearing fruit. They're multiplying to the point that Pharaoh's getting freaked out. And he's like, we got to do something. And so he starts attacking. So God's plan is on, and he's blessing his people, but his people are coming under attack and really suffering. And why is it happening this way? Well, in chapter 3, God calls Moses, and he makes it clear that what he's going to do is he's going to save Israel a certain way in order to reveal who he is. So he's accomplishing salvation. There's stuff that Israel and the world needs to know about God. God wants to be known for who he actually is. And so he's designed Israel's salvation as a way in which to put his glory on display. And then last week, we looked at chapter 4, which is the response. And Moses basically says he doesn't think the people are going to believe. He doesn't believe, really. He's like, God, you got to find somebody else. This isn't going to work. And then the end of chapter 4, he's like, but if I go, they're not going to believe. They don't know you. And why would they listen to me? And so this is really the question here from chapters 4 to 6. The question that these chapters are revolving around is, will Israel believe? Moses says, I don't think Israel's going to believe. And so God gives Israel a couple signs. And you remember, Moses throws his staff on the ground, picks it up. It becomes a snake. He picks it up. It becomes a staff again. And he puts his hand in. It becomes leprous. He pulls it out. So he's going to be able to overcome the serpent. He's going to be able to cleanse Israel. And then there's the water to blood. And so the purpose of these signs is all helping Israel believe. And again, this is important. Even in Exodus, it's about faith. Will Israel believe? And by the end of that chapter, chapter 4, last week when we left, it looked good. Verse 31 says, and the people believed. But now there's a test. So you have to kind of like push on that faith a little bit to see if it is real faith. And so coming into chapter 5, we're going to look at sort of the reality of Israel's faith. And we can read just the first line there.
Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.
Okay, so this is cool. So the rescue's starting. God sent Moses to Pharaoh. Part of the purpose is to reveal who he is. God is coming and identifying himself as Yahweh, the God of Israel, and he's making a demand of Pharaoh. And how does Pharaoh respond?
But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go.
And that's kind of a key question for the whole book. Moses asked, he said, Israel's not going to know who you are, and now Pharaoh's like, who is the Lord? And this is less of a question and more of a challenge. He's like setting himself up in opposition to Yahweh. And to make his rebellion really clear, Moses and Aaron make the request again.
Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. And Pharaoh said, behold, the people of the land are now many, and you may make them rest for their burdens. The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks, as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore, they cry, let us go and offer our sacrifice to God. Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying ones.
Okay, so Moses and Aaron, explain again. God met with them. And what does Pharaoh say? He doesn't even really listen. He just makes it harder for Israel. And he says the reason they're making this request is because they're lazy. And we're going to see him say that over and over and over again. And so basically he's saying, you're lying. There is no God. You're just coming up with this sort of excuse because you don't want to work. So he doesn't take God's words seriously. And in the end, he says it's false words. And so what's his goal through this persecution? His goal is that God's people might serve him, Pharaoh, and stop paying attention to lying words. And what happens next?
So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves, wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least.
Okay, so just for one second, what is the first thing the taskmasters and the foremen of the people say? The very first thing they say.
Thus says Pharaoh.
And so that's kind of significant, because what did Moses just say? Thus says the Lord. So what's going on is Pharaoh's taking on God. God says this, Pharaoh says this. And he's basically saying Yahweh has no power here. The only being in the universe that you need to pay attention to is me, Pharaoh. Thus says Pharaoh.
So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, your daily task each day, as when there was straw. And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday, as in the past?
Okay, so what's Pharaoh doing here? He's basically humiliating them, right? He scatters them, and then they have to find stubble to make bricks, so they still need straw to make bricks, but he's not going to give it to them. He's kind of saying, I am the source of what you need. And when you are not looking to me, I'm going to make it difficult for you. And then their leaders are beaten. So they have the foremen of the people. They were Israelites. And they were beaten. And they were mocked. There's physical violence. Even their, you know, even the most important people among them don't have any power. And so what do the foremen of the sons of Israel do? This is important, the next little line there.
The next part, I'm sorry. I wasn't asleep this morning.
Yeah.
Then the foremen of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh.
Okay, so stop there, because that's really significant. What just happened? This is Israel. They're the foremen of the people of Israel. What do they do?
Came and cried.
They came and cried, but the so... Earlier in Exodus, the people cry. It doesn't actually say they cry out to God. You'd expect them to say they cry out to God, but it says they cry, and God hears, and he comes to rescue them. This is the first time it says they cry to someone. And who do they cry? Instead of going to God, they go to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh's strategy is working, basically. This is an illustration of Satan's goal. God is going out about saving his people, but what does Satan want God's people to do? He wants God's people to stop trusting in God and start looking to him, start trusting in his idols. And so what do they, and it gets worse. What do they say next? Or what do they actually say?
People of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, why do you treat your servants like this?
Okay, so what do they call themselves?
Servants.
So what did God say he wanted Israel to go into the wilderness to be able to become? He says, I'll deliver them from Egypt that they might be, that they might serve me, that they might be my servants. Now the people of Israel are saying what about themselves? They're saying they're Pharaoh's servants. So they're acknowledging to Pharaoh, you are my master. You are our master. And so this is Pharaoh's master plan to break God's people and to show God, I'm the one in charge here. I'm the real master. And then look at what they keep saying over and over.
No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people.
So over and over, your servants, your servants. And what is Pharaoh's response?
But he said, you are idle, you are idle. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.
So the insult here is, you're lazy, you're lazy. And he says it over and over again. And basically, lazy people have a lot of time on their hands. Is kind of making things up. And he's saying, what you're saying about Yahweh isn't even real. You're just making them up because you want to do what you want to do. And so he has no respect for God and his word. And see what he says next.
Go now and work. No straw will be given you, but you must deliver the same number of bricks. The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, you shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day.
So you remember the question at the beginning was, will Israel believe? And so this is a test, because it seemed like they believed. But was it true? Was it genuine? Now look at how they respond when they meet God's representatives here.
They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants and have put a sword in their hands to kill us.
Okay, so this is Israel suffered and they're in a scary position. But if you go back to chapter 1 and you think about the midwives, when they were in that scary position, Pharaoh was asking them to do something. It says they feared God. And as a result, they did what was right and they were blessed. And we even get to know their names, so they get to receive a name. But what's Israel's response? They don't believe God is saving. They believe God's against them. And they say something at the beginning of verse 21 here, or this verse, that's kind of doesn't make sense. What do they say they want God to do to Moses and Aaron? To judge them. Now, what had Moses and Aaron done, actually? Had Moses and Aaron done something in this book that God should judge them for, from God's perspective? What had Moses and Aaron just came back from doing when they went to Pharaoh? And who told them to talk to Pharaoh?
God.
Yeah, so they were obeying God in a scary situation. Mm-hmm. So it makes no sense to say God should judge Moses and Aaron. Unless you're looking at the situation from Pharaoh's perspective. And so God's perspective on Moses and Aaron is like, hey, you're obedient. But the point is, whose perspective is dominating the way Israel thinks about life? It's not God's. It's Pharaoh's. And so that's where Israel's at. They're not believing God. Pharaoh is the one who is dominating the way they look at the world. But maybe Moses. What's Moses' response? Does he believe? And that's the next line there.
Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all.
Okay, so this is really ironic, what Moses is saying here. Moses is coming and saying, God, you're doing evil to this people. Why'd you send me? But even what he's saying here is ironic, because what had God said in the previous chapter would happen? In chapter 4, verse 21, if you look back, God literally said, this is exactly how it's going to go. God had said, Moses, you're going to go to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's not going to believe. The reason he's not going to believe is because I need to show these people who I am, and I'm going to do some great signs. So what happened should have been a confirmation to Moses that God was keeping his word. Like, if I told you, go outside, you're going to meet three people, you know, they're going to say, tacos taste good, and then the next guy's going to say, hippopotamus is fly or something, and then you go outside and all three of those things happen, you should walk away being like, wow, Josh kind of knew, I have more faith that Josh knew what he was talking about. But the opposite happens to Moses. He's suffering. He's afraid, and what's it causing Moses to do? It's causing him to get angry at God. And what does this tell us about Moses' knowledge of God and his relationship with God? Why is he questioning God here really at this point? It's not so much his circumstances.
Still not so strong. Yeah.
Yeah, he just doesn't know God. He doesn't really know how powerful God is. He still thinks
it's like revealing like a baby. When God first told him to go do this and all those excuses he was trying to come up with.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
That's really where he's still at.
That's where he's still at. Yeah. Exactly. So this is a problem because remember, Israel is supposed to be a nation that proclaims God to the entire world, and it's clear Israel doesn't know God because they think Pharaoh is still the one who's in charge. And Moses is supposed to be this great deliverer, this great rescuer. And it's clear he doesn't really know God, and specifically he doesn't know how great and how sovereign and even how good God is. And I love that this is now chapter 6, but I love how chapter 6 begins because Israel is so scared. They're in the room with these wealthy people like we just read in Psalms. And they're so scared because they think these people have such power. But how does God respond? I don't know who's next.
I think we finished on
this. Oh, yeah.
But the Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will ascend the mountain, with a strong hand he will drive them out of the desert.
Okay, so this is so cool. Obviously, God is not intimidated by his people's lack of belief. It's almost like he's not, you know, he's like, okay, Moses, be quiet for a second here. He's not intimidated by Pharaoh for sure. So Pharaoh, if you remember, his concern back in chapter 1 was he doesn't want the people to leave because then they wouldn't have slaves, right? And in the previous chapter, God comes and he's like, let my people leave. He's like, there's no way on earth that I'm going to let these people go. But what is going to happen actually? Who does God say is going to make the people go in this verse? And how's he going to do it? Yeah, so in other words, this is a complete turnaround. This is the guy who just said, there is no way in the entire world that you can ever leave. I am completely in charge here. And God says, no, Moses. What actually is going to happen is Pharaoh is going to be like giving you the keys to the car. He's going to be like driving you out of town and like throwing you out. Like he's going to get you out of here with a strong hand. And so it's so important to understand because Pharaoh was claiming to be a god. And he was the head of the greatest superpower in the world. And in a sense, he's like, in the chapter 4, he's like, I'm going to war against Israel's God. I don't even think I think you're making him up. And so evil is warring against God here. But the outcome is not in doubt. How in control is God? This is, he's not just taking evil and using it for good. This is like a total and humiliating defeat of evil. Like, he's just basically, he's saying, I'm just going to show you that evil has no chance against me. And so Moses hasn't understood who God is. And so now God comes and reminds Moses who he is, what's happening. Moses is viewing God through his circumstances, but it's like God's coming and saying, no, Moses, you need to look at your circumstances through what's true about me. And so this is the next paragraph here.
God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners.
Okay, moreover, stop there just for 1 second, because God's saying he didn't reveal his name to the patriarchs, but he did tell them. They knew he was Yahweh. They knew the letters. They didn't quite understand what the name meant. It's almost like with your wife when you knew her name before you got married, but like 10 years in, you know your wife. You could say, I didn't even know you back when we first got married. Now I know you. And so that's sort of what he's saying about Abraham. And they knew me. There were parts they knew. They knew I was Yahweh. But here in this, what's going to happen with this salvation, you're going to come to know me in a deeper way. And he says something really interesting next. He says, who does he say he's going to give the land to? He has to establish my covenant with them to do what? to give them the
mandate.
And who's the them?
Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, so what does that assume is going to have to happen in the future for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Because where are they right now? They are
dead.
So God's saying, I've made a promise to give them the land. So what's going to have to happen for God to keep that promise?
They got to not be dead.
Yeah, they got to not be dead. It's kind of hard to get the land if you're dead. So God is saying he has power over good and evil and over life and death. And we have hope because what kind of God is he? And he says something here in the next statement that encourages us.
Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the people of Israel whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for possession. I am the Lord.
Yeah, right there. So the hope for Israel is that God is God. And what's God going to do? Pharaoh said in chapter 5, verse 4, he said, get back to your burdens. Stop talking to me. Get back to your burdens. But God says, I'm going to bring you out from under those burdens. I'm God, not Pharaoh. So his word doesn't win here. And then what? I'll deliver you from slavery. So I'm going to deal with the suffering, the burden, but I'm going to deal with that by dealing with the cause. You're no longer going to be slaves to Egypt. And then he says, I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to set you free in this awesome way. And what is the purpose? Not just to get you out from under those burdens, but to be my people. And what are we learning about God? He's saving so that these people can have a personal relationship with him, so that they can know him, and so that he can keep his promises to bless them. And that's amazing and should bring a lot of joy. But how does Israel respond?
Moses spoke thus to the people of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and harsh slavery.
Yeah. And so that's a little counseling insight there, isn't it? That sometimes people's spirits are really broken, and it's hard for them to hear what they need to hear as a result. And they don't believe. But again, we're asking, what about Moses? Because remember, the question at the beginning is, will Israel believe? And right now, it doesn't seem like they're in a place to believe, but maybe Moses, right? So what about Moses?
Okay. So the Lord said to Moses, go in, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of this land. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me, for I am of uncircumcised lips? But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt.
So again, Moses doesn't believe. And actually, he just is, he's sort of like on repeat here. He just brings up the same excuse. It's like nothing ever happened and God didn't say anything. He's like, I told you that they weren't going to listen. They didn't listen. And remember, I'm not good at talking. So I don't see how this is going to work. And yet, again, that doesn't stop God. It's almost like God's just like, okay, Moses. The Lord spoke to Moses and he gives him a charge. I want you to go and do this. And we're going to see now, like, that doesn't stop God. In verses 14 and following, and something really kind of we might think is sort of boring here happens, because all of a sudden he starts just talking a long list of names, and I guess I'm the lucky one here, but these are the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben, the sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman, Zohar. That's kind of a cool name. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. the sons of Gershon, Libni, and Shimei, by their clans, the son of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel, the years of the life of Kohath being 133 years. The sons of Merari, Mali, and Mushi. These are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Some biblical names don't get much traction for Amram took his wife as his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, the years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Izhar, Korah, Nepheg, and Zikri. The sons of Uziel, Mishael, Elsaphan, and Sithri. Aaron took his wife Elsheba, the daughter of Amminadab, and the sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The sons of Korah, Issar, Elkanah, and Abisaph. These are the clans of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas, the black. That's what that means. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. And so, okay, so this is a genealogy. This is one of those times when you're reading your Bible and you're like, wait a second, this is weird. We were like having a good story going on, and now I'm reading all these names. But where do we get a lot of genealogies already in our reading? Well, there's only one book before this, so it's not too hard. Genesis, right? And so let's think about genealogies and how they might encourage us about Moses. Because Moses, if we're looking at him so far in Exodus, has he seemed like a great deliverer?
No.
And then at the end of that last section, we're just like, Moses, seriously, and we might be looking at God and being like, are you sure this is the guy? Because, like, I'm not sure this is the guy. Can't you use Miriam or, like, you know, somebody else? There's got to be somebody else. And yet we saw in Exodus 2 that God's raising up Moses to be Israel's rescuer. And in Genesis, genealogies remind us about God's promise of the seed of the woman. And so at this point, we might be disappointed in Moses, but this is like a reset. It's kind of like, okay, let me just give you a little side, you know, put the movie on pause, and let me just make sure you know Moses really is the guy. God has a plan. He's going to use the seed of the woman to defeat Satan. Moses is in the line of the seed. And so this story is going to be about how God rescues Israel and how God transforms Moses and uses Moses. And now that we've seen that, like, okay, Moses is the guy. You're serious that Moses is the guy. We're asking, would Israel and Moses believe? And they didn't. But God has chosen Moses, he says. And so he's going to use Moses. And so now that that's clear in our minds, verses 28 through 30, it's like we're ready to go again. Mm-hmm. And the story's back online, and you can finish this out.
These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me?
Which sounds a lot like verses 10 to 12, right? Mm-hmm. So this was sort of like you're driving in the car. Your wife thinks you're lost. You're like, okay, let me show you the GPS. Or let me show you back in the days when you just had a map. You're like, let's stop the car. Look at the map. No, we're going in the right direction. Okay, put the map away. Let's just start driving again. That's what was happening with that genealogy. God's going to use Moses in spite of Moses' failure. We're sure of that. So now we're ready for the next chapters to see how God goes to war with evil and glorifies himself by saving his people.